Afternoon and welcome everyone. My name is Paul Salem. I'm the Senior Vice President for Policy Analysis and Programs at the Middle East Institute. We're very pleased that you've joined us today for this conference exploring the challenges and the path ahead for a troubled Libya. We are recording this event and will post a video and a podcast of it on our website, www.mei.edu. So please put your mobile devices on silent, please. We do encourage tweeting, and if you are tweeting, please use the hashtag, #MEI Libya. This conference was made possible in great part by the support of Garda World Federal Services, a corporate member of the Middle East Institute. We thank Mr. Pete Dordal and his team at Garda World for their commitment to MEI and the work we do. Our examination of the path forward for Libya is timely, coming at a moment when the UN Special Envoy, a friend and a colleague, Dr. Hassan Salami, has proposed an action plan for resolving the country's political impasse, and when the U.S. has re-engaged militarily to combat ISIS in the country. After conducting what he described as broad consultations throughout Libyan society, Dr. Salami proposed a process for reconsidering the UN-brokered political agreement of 2015. The aim is to help Libyans develop a roadmap toward institutional reforms, a new constitution, new governing structures, and elections. The UN representative emphasizes that Libyans must control the process for its outcome to be legitimate and sustainable, and warns that various powerful parties in Libya continue from time to time to play for advantage in the current disunity and conflict. The welter of overlapping conflicts leaves many Libyans at personal risk, many more of them without public services or economic opportunity. Many have been internally displaced or sought refuge outside the country. And despite its internal dangers, Libya has also become a transit country for migrants from neighboring countries seeking entry to Europe. And while the country's oil sector has tripled production from last year, much of the rest of the economy remains paralyzed, offering insufficient opportunities to Libya's population, especially for its young people. To help us examine these issues, we're joined by a diverse group of experts on the political, national security, economic, and social aspects of Libya's challenges. Our first panel will consider how the international community can promote stability and security in the country. We thank all our panelists for participation and are particularly honored to have the senior diplomat representing Libya in the United States, Ms. Wafa Bougheris, as a member of the first panel. After the coffee break, our second panel will share their views on improving humanitarian relief and advancing development in Libya. One of Europe's leading young scholars on Libya will take part by Skype in the conversation, which will also feature the UN Deputy Special Representative for Libya, Ms. Maria Ribeiro, and other distinguished panelists. Moderating this panel, panel one, will be my colleague, MEI non-resident senior fellow, Mr. Jonathan Weiner. Before joining MEI, Mr. Weiner served as the U.S. Special Envoy for Libya under Secretary of State John Kerry. He has also served the U.S. with distinction in several positions in the Department of State and in the U.S. Senate. Jonathan will introduce the panel members and get our program underway. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Weiner and our distinguished panel.
Thanks, Paul. We're going to all try and speak swiftly and succinctly so that we can get into a discussion and then be available to answer your questions all over the course of the next 65-75 minutes. First major point, in Libya, political, economic, and security issues are always inexorably and intricately intertwined. They really cannot be segregated from one another. Second, there is concrete progress on the ground. I used to measure my success or failure every day as special envoy by whether Libya was pumping more or less oil. If Libya is pumping oil, it means enough people have enough stake in the country to let it happen. It was down to 250,000 barrels a day at the apogee of my tenure. not a good situation, and the revenue was down to a few billion dollars a year, not something sustainable. It is now running at around a million barrels a day. That is a huge, huge development. Tripoli, while it's far from perfect, has stabilized to a very considerable extent, as you will hear from Nigel. Security on the ground is a lot better than it was and continues to improve. And on the political side, as Paul has suggested to you, there is an actual roadmap that's been presented by the SRSG. The roadmap is being followed in important ways. There have been 5 rounds of meetings now between the State Council and the House of Representatives to discuss such issues as addressing the future of the Presidency Council, potentially moving it down from a dysfunctional 9 to hopefully a more functional 3, separating out a prime minister, and addressing finally the security, core security issue under an Article 8 annex of how you have a national security structure for Libya that addresses, among other things, the issues associated with General Haftar. So this is real progress. They're talking about these things. They're not skipping meetings. They're not in hiding. There are also another groups discussing Libya's future constitution. There's a plan for a national conference and then elections within a year after that. So there is a roadmap, and that's progress. Is it absolutely possible? Is it conceivable that Libya could become a good news story even now? What are the conditions necessary for political security and economic progress? Our 4 panelists are Wafa Boukgeges, Libya's chief diplomat in the United States, who will update us on Libya's current policies to achieve stability. Nigel Lee, regional director for Garda World Federal Services, who has special insight not only into the security situation on the ground, but some very concrete views on the economy and the political situation. To my right, Ben Fishman of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, who formerly was the lead person on Libya in the Obama administration, and who will ask to help us evaluate the options for Libya going forward from where we are now, what might work. Lastly on this panel is Jason Pack, executive director of the U.S. Libya Business Association, who has his own diagnosis on the structural reasons and historic reasons for Libya's economic issues, and some concrete recommendations on how we go forward. So we're going to try and cram in all of that and then be asking one another questions and having some dialogue and then opening things up to you. With that, let me turn to Ambassador Boukgeges. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. Distinguished colleagues and guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's my distinct pleasure to be among you all today to discuss the path forward for Libya. And just like my colleagues have said, we're going to be examining opportunities for the United States and the international community to advance Libya's security and mobilize to meet humanitarian challenges. I seize this opportunity to thank the Middle East Institute for organizing this timely symposium in Libya, indeed. As my colleagues have indicated, indeed it's timely as the UN Special Envoy, Mr. Ghassan Salama, to Libya recently announced plans to revamp the current political agreement, reconsidering past shortcomings and seeking to widen the participation and opportunity for all Libyans to be part of the political process. I'm just going to give a brief on the ongoing, and then I think we'll open it with the discussions to answer and elaborate more on certain issues. The plan as proposed includes amendments to the current Libyan political agreement and seeks to build a framework for a renewed political process. According to Mr. Ghassan Salama, and in his words, this plan is a rationalization of what he heard from Libyans when he crisscrossed the country, listening to hundreds of Libyans from political classes to non-politicians. After and if a set of amendments to the Libyan political agreement is agreed upon by committees that have already resumed work and meeting as of last week, a national reconciliation conference will be convened to include all Libyan groups to pin down a roadmap for constitution, institutional reforms, and presidential and parliamentarian elections by the end of next year, during next year. To this end, and on this path forward, certainly support is requested from the U.S. and the international community. The U.S. and the international community can contribute a lot to the success of the Libyan dialogue and reconciliation and peace process, and this can start now in parallel with the Libyan talks and dialogue. Top priority is to align their positions on Libya. And we believe there is finally a good sign of this. It was reiterated in the high-level meeting on the sides of UNGA, convened by the General Secretary of the UN, and there was a resounding support to amend the Libyan political agreement by all member states and to build a framework for a renewal political process. So this was good news for us Libyans at last. The U.S. and the international community can support the peace process that will put the country on the track by supporting the government on many issues using both bottom-up and top-bottom approaches to resolve many issues that have been drivers for instability and conflict. The political agreement will need for us to work on other issues in parallel to make sure that it will be a sustainable political solution and a sustainable peace process. I'm going to specifically name some of the issues that have been a driver for conflicts and instability, and we do wish to see support from the international community, their expertise in supporting us on that. I will start by saying supporting efforts to unite our military and security institutions and supporting building its capacity to be able to resume its full duties in securing borders, enforcing law, and securing our points of entry, all points of entry to the country, secure governmental institutions, and certainly with the enforcement of law, this is one pillar for countering terrorism, illegal immigration, organized crime, but also it will help us improve our current financial crisis, economical crisis. It will, the security, once it's apparent and imposed, will help us have a sustainable production of oil and generate revenues that are important for the country to provide services and to improve the economical current situation. To the financial situation has been grave. There is lack of liquidity in banks. The value of the dinar has degraded, and that impacts the lives of people greatly. And security in cities and around different neighbors and banks is very important, because we heard from the governor of the central bank many times that for people to have trust in the banks and bring back their cash and deposit it in the banks, they need to feel the sense of security, and that organized crimes, kidnapping, extortion is being stopped, and people don't feel a threat anymore. Only then we can improve the crisis happening. Another major drive for conflict that needs to be eliminated and dealt with through building the capacity for local governance and supporting decentralization. Empowering local governance and decentralization and share of power and revenues will enable delivering security, health, education, and resolve financial crisis on local levels, municipality levels, and in different towns. efforts to support the return of IDPs, internally displaced people, and Libyan refugees into neighboring countries back to their homes is very essential to support the reconciliation process and to support the peace process and to have more people buy in the political agreement and participate in the peace process. Supporting devastated cities torn by war against terrorist groups, namely Benghazi and Sirte, is going to be very crucial. And to be able to reconstruct those cities and support tremendous humanitarian efforts to recover from the war. And one of the most painful issues these towns are dealing with now is the removal of mines. And it's been done by very modest local efforts, and support is sought to be able to help us remove those mines that are taking the lives until today. Furthermore, within the context of countering terrorism, I will add that military operations alone will not be sufficient in countering terrorism. And we saw, even though they've been defeated in Benghazi and Sirte, but we saw their ability to regroup and resume. And that's why stabilizing the country, building a unified, strong national government and strong security institutions will be the only way and the most successful, in parallel, of course, with military operations, but it will be the most effective in countering those terrorist groups. The same goes for illegal immigration and for the organized crime that has been that has had a big haven in our country, unfortunately, as a result of porous borders. And it seems no matter what efforts are going on in combating them somehow by military operations, but as long as we have porous borders, the influx is continuing. And that's why a stable, strong, united government with stable, strong military and security institutions will be the way to combat all of those threats. Finally, before my colleagues talk on different other specific topics, and then we open it up. Finally, and in conclusion, I feel that we Libyans now are conscious enough of the windows of opportunity before us in our stability and prosperity. And with this, the foreign negative interference will be neutralized, and hopefully only the positive support to us will prevail. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Rugegas. There's a lot of rich material in that. And I noted that you ended up with a focus on Libyans recognizing they need to get their country together, and the focus that internationals can be positive factors or negative ones. And one thing I hope we'll be able to talk about today is what the U.S. role should be going forward. But she also talked a lot about security and the centrality of security, which is a perfect lead-in to Nigel's presentation, which hopefully will include discussing the current security situation, what some of the legacy is that has to still be overcome, and how we should be thinking about security, integrated security forces, the terrorist problem, and the migration problem. Nigel.
Jonathan, thank you. I'd like to open, first of all, by saying a huge thank you to Ambassador Rugegas for all of the substantial and continued support that she has given to conducting business in Libya for U.S. companies. It's incredibly important that the commercial sector fills some of the vacuum that exists and supports what the wider diplomatic international community is also trying to achieve. Guard World's operated in Libya continually for the last 7 years. We've seen the change, we've experienced the instability, and we've seen, thankfully, the regrowth and the investment firsthand. My main message for today, despite the various points in detail I will come onto, is that Libya is open and viable for business, and should be exploited in that sense to aid the country. Libya is an incredibly challenging environment. A lot of people look at it purely thinking of it as a single nation state. To put it into context, half the size of Western Europe, or drawing lines from South Dakota to Louisiana or New Mexico to Michigan, but with only 3/4 the population of New York, and adding to that 22 million weapon systems at the last count. It's a deeply unstable, very sparsely populated area. To the meat of what we're here to talk about, and I'll start with Islamic State. All possible international support has got to be lent to Libya to rid the country not only of the extremists, but most importantly, and to back the points that have been made already, the extremist views that exist in the country. And it's very much focusing that on the social media, the mayoral level, and the lower religious orders to make sure that we can actually add longevity to the stability program. The international counter-terrorist effort is significant. It's ongoing, and thankfully most of it is not seen in the press. However, anybody who does deal with that must also, I believe, fundamentally remember this must be a Libyan-led initiative. Nobody is going to support international forces coming in with long boots on the ground. Possibly more importantly, we must look at migration as a significant destabilizing factor in the country. The three ways I look at solving this problem, and we've studied it long and hard with inside the company, is to educate, interdict, and repatriate. If we can educate the vulnerable in their countries of origins and end their belief that the dreams they have when they set off will end up on the roads of gold in Europe, then we've got a chance of slowing the flow that's coming into the country. Interdiction and the migration into the sea has got to be continued in order to deter more flows and more money coming into the country, into the black market and to the smugglers. Which leads me to two final points on this. Repatriation. There are over, we believe, 1 million individuals stuck in Libya, most of whom probably don't wish to actually be there. So if we can repatriate those who have been interdicted, or repatriate those who through sheer force of circumstance have been educated to understand that they no longer wish to follow this route, we will again start the cycle back in their countries of origin. One of the more important things that is destabilizing Libya when it comes to migration is the views of the Libyan people. And a lot of them are looking at the international aid for migrants through the prism of, why are you helping all these foreigners in my country when you're not helping me and my people while we are suffering under the current conditions in the country? Away from migration and other pieces that are certainly destabilizing factors, fuel subsidies. The very low cost of fuel and the endemic smuggling that is going on out of Libya for fuel is a plague across the entire country and is providing a vast amount of money, all falling into the wrong hands at the moment. Unless those fuel subsidies are either reduced or preferably removed, we are not going to see an increase in the stability. It will, of course, come with immediate and hopefully short-term economic pain for the Libyans that exist in the country. The banking liquidity and the exchange rates are another very big and hard stop in my mind as to where we look at this. They're preventing genuine investment and genuine commercial interest occurring in the company, in the country. Without a functioning banking system that can be not only seen to function but be trusted to allow hard currency to come in and out of the country and the Libyan dinar to be exchanged at a devalued rate, again, we are going to see a black market economy thrive and continue to fund all those elements that we don't wish to survive. The situation on the ground, I believe, is exacerbated by the negativity and often overly dramatic representation of Libya in the press. This is not the Beirut of the 1980s. You can move freely through Tripoli as you can in Misrata, as you can in Benghazi, Ghadames, Ghat, and Sebha. It's got to be remembered, and I would advise everybody here, please, when you see the social media or you listen to commentators, please understand who they are, what their influences are, and actually whether they are putting out, in the modern diction, fake news or propaganda. It's not very helpful for anybody. The complexities in Libyan society are massive, and I believe the key piece that the international community, commercial and diplomatic, is focusing on are the Katibas, are the militias. What we are forgetting in its greatest strength in Libya is the tribal system and the tribal complexities, which can be very difficult to navigate, but also add a huge amount to how we can engage with Libya and help it rebuild itself. On the political side, we must continue to support and influence and calm the GNA in all its elements and give it all the help that it needs. Most importantly, I would suggest, and to back the ambassador's point, the international community has probably got to work harder externally to Libya to make sure it has a combined message and a combined opinion on how to assist the country, rather than splintering and fracturing and therefore not actually helping what's going on the ground. In terms of armed conflict, the press is not particularly helpful, but it does portray a genuinely true attitude to what is happening. What I would emphasize is that violence in Libya is sporadic, it's short-lived, it's intense, and it's generally misunderstood by the international community. It is all too easy to label violent events as terrorist activities or terrorist events, when often tribal conflict, or more commonly criminality, are the bigger causes to blame for the individual events. So to sum up, solutions advocated by Guard World for Libyan leaders to consider and foreign leaders to consider. Have patience to achieve the right governance for an outcome rather than rushing into our view of elections in 2018. Re-establish a functioning banking system, including the devaluing openly of the Libyan dinar. Remove fuel subsidies, and then hopefully we'll see in 2 to 3 years a stable North African country that can contribute to the region.
Thank you, Nigel. I think it's very clear and very concrete set of recommendations. I asked a minute ago what the U.S. role might be, and here I'm going to turn to someone who's had a lot of opportunity to think about that over an extended period of time, Ben Fishman, formerly with the NSC, and now with the Washington Institute. Ben?
Thanks, Jonathan, thanks to the Institute for hosting this. It's great to have so many interested people in Washington thinking about Libya, and because that's it doesn't seem to be the case in the administration, at least on the higher level, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. I'm going to talk about what I see as the stages of a U.S. involvement post-2011. But not to necessarily dwell on the history, we can debate that at length at another time, but more to establish the context of where we come from so we can analyze and chart a way forward. I see four stages of involvement from the Obama administration. First, from March 2011 to October, when we were actually at war in the NATO operation. That definitely was our most intensive stage, both militarily, diplomatically, financially, sanctions and everything else. Then there was the transitional stage from November 2011, and I end that stage on a specific date as September 11, 2012, when the attack on our mission in Benghazi occurred. And you can't overstate from the internal U.S. government perspective how much that attack impacted our approach, the psychology of approaching Libya, and the bureaucratic follow-up that was necessary. It's obviously become politicized, but on a very practical, functional level, it hijacked our approach to Libya, our Libya policy. And then I say from September 2012 to July 14, and that was the stage where we tried to recover from the tragedy of Benghazi, and only to be forced to evacuate our embassy because of the emerging civil war and the violence that occurred, emerging violence between the Dawn and Dignity factions, literally lobbing shells over our embassy. And then July 2014 to the end of the administration, which included obviously the CERT operation from the summer of 2016 to December, but also some intensive rounds of diplomacy led by the gentleman to my left and also his boss, Secretary Kerry, sending a very important but underappreciated president that only the government of Libya could export oil because we interdicted the first and only shipment that was attempted by the Easterners, and some important sanctions that were imposed to signal that spoilers could not affect the unity process. Now, you can cut and dice those specific dates, but I chose to select them on those bases. And throughout that, there were several common approaches within each phase. We counted on partnerships with Libyans and Europeans and some regional players. The U.S. was never going to lead these efforts, either on the kinetic military phase in 2011 or the post-conflict phase. But we wanted to support a Libyan-led process and get our allies to contribute. And that included the needed stabilization efforts on the economic front, on the social front, on the civil society front. We did some very important work. Some very important work is continuing to be ongoing. It's more complicated than ever without an actual embassy on the ground, but we've managed to do some stabilization efforts, local governments support that Wafa referred to a minute ago. More needs to be done, but we've managed to contain it. And obviously the CT counterterrorism commitment has been persistent. The ISIS campaign was the most dramatic exhibition of that effort. But don't forget, before we were focused on capturing the perpetrator of the Benghazi issue, who's now facing a trial about a mile away. Other capture programs and specific bombing efforts against other terrorists in the Maghreb. So enter Trump. How did this change? Well, there was two theories, I think, predominating when he came into office. One, that the anti-Islamist faction around him would dominate and convince him to support General Haftar and the anti-Islamist coalition in Libya, therefore changing U.S. policy from supporting a unity government to leaning on one side. That didn't transpire much to the disappointment of several Libyan actors and some in Washington. There was another theory that Trump would seize on Libya as an area that Obama failed on and make some commitments to succeed where Obama failed. That didn't transpire. And the best evidence that we had was when Italian Prime Minister Gentiloni came in. And then during the press conference, Gentiloni, an Italian journalist, asked Gentiloni what you see the U.S. role in Libya is. And Gentiloni said, we agree with the president that U.S. Has an important role in bringing the Libya together, and he expanded on it. And Trump, in no uncertain terms, said, we have no role in Libya. And corrected himself and said only the ISIS CT role that will play a part. And I think that's held true for the last several months. We've seen recently, in the last 2 weeks, a couple of drone attacks against select ISIS targets south of Sirte. AFRICOM is and the military are continually monitoring that situation, and obviously the attacks indicate their continuing commitment to fighting those threats and limiting the prospect that ISIS will recover in Libya. But I fully agree with Wafa's statement that that CT is not you can't succeed on the CT front without a broader political strategy. You can't just make occasional bombing strikes or even special forces operations without a broader political strategy. So where does that leave the U.S. policy? And we've, the Trump administration, the State Department, has made support statements in support of the UN effort before Salami's action plan and a few days after the plan was announced. But, you know, in all seriousness, an indication of the level of support was Gentiloni sat on the high-level meeting that was convened in New York, and Theresa May was sitting at the meeting, and we sent our Undersecretary of State. And that, I think, sums it up. And I was reminded that when Tillerson had to come out yesterday to re-establish his loyalty to the president, he talked about his commitment to the America first foreign policy agenda of the president. And that struck me because I forgot about that phrase, and I don't think that's common. He commonly uses it. So I went back and figured out when he last used it. And he actually introduced it, Tillerson actually introduced the phrase in May when he came out to the State Department in the Gene Acheson Auditorium and made his first serious remarks. And how does he interpret America first foreign policy as being? I'll just quote a little bit of it. Our partnerships and our alliances are critical to our success in both of those areas, meaning national security and economic prosperity. But as we have progressed over the last 20 years, as we participated in those changes, we were promoting relationships, we were promoting economic activity, we were promoting trade with a lot of these emerging economies, and we just kind of lost track of how we were doing. And as a result, things got a little bit out of balance. And I think that's, as you hear the president talk about it, that's what he really speaks about is, look, things have gotten out of balance, and these are really important relationships to us, and they're really important alliances, and we've got to bring them back into balance. He obviously wasn't speaking on prepared remarks. He was wandering around. And the only reference to the Middle East in that speech was related to CT and ISIS issues. So what does all that mean for Libya? I just think it's going to be a continuation now of just CT policy, and I mean narrowly focused CT policy. As long as ISIS isn't contained, we'll give nominal support to the UN's efforts, but ultimately I think the administration is focusing it'll be Europe's and the UN's problem. I don't want to dismiss Ambassador Bodhi's efforts to meet on the ground with the players. He did go to Tripoli for the first time And the middle administration he did was accompanied by General Waldhauser from AFRICOM. He has been meeting with the parties, but in order to make a difference, an impact, I think it has to come at a higher level. And don't forget the inclusion of Libya now in the latest travel ban probably sends a negative, very negative symbol of what how Libyans view the U.S. role. If I were advising the administration, and obviously I'm not, what they can do within the limits of these America First lens beyond the scenario CT issues, I would focus on two or three areas. I would, in the midst of things that Salome said need to occur concurrently with the constitution process and the political dialogue and everything, he also emphasized there's a need to invest in the ongoing stabilization fund and to get others to do so. I think the second panel will address this in more specifics. But I think the U.S. has a diplomatic role in encouraging people to contribute, as if not contribute in a symbolic way itself, and also to Wafa's last points about spoilers from the outside. If we're not going to invest ourselves heavily in getting the two sides together, or the multiple sides, but primarily two factions together, we can emphasize that in our dialogue with our regional partners that they should let the UN handle this and be helpful as opposed to not constructive. And there's plenty of technical stuff we can do on a local level that I think the best second panel is best positioned to talk about. But I think those are realistic things that our administration could be doing consistent with their overall framework for Libya. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Ben. It's a bit of a dose of reality. It makes me wonder whether the U.S. military will be the lead agency in the making of a Libya policy in the weeks and months to come. It does have a very large footprint, potentially, of activities it could engage in. We're all touching on all of the issues, which, as I said, were intertwined. With that, I would like to turn to Jason, who will focus principally on the economy, but will cover other issues in the process.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a distinct honor to be included on a panel with so much experience in formulating policy towards Libya. So I want to add my own unique perspective, which I've garnered from representing the major American companies who work in Libya. So I'd like to touch upon the issue of Libya's myriad semi-sovereign economic institutions and how a lack of a centralized and coherent economic kind of overarching controlling body has impeded the process to have a stable post-Qaddafi transition and create a new political solution. I think a key thing to conceptualize if you are not plugged into the Libya field is the extent to which Libya is dissimilar from all other Arab oil-producing societies. Libya is a stateless state, and it was set up that way under Qaddafi deliberately. He never wanted a centrally functioning bureaucracy which could challenge him. And this is in distinct opposition to Kuwait or Qatar or Saudi, where, of course, you've got the extractive state, which then has the welfare component that distributes resources. And by the way, is that just me? Is there a horrible hissing? It's everyone? Okay. So let's keep that point in mind. So under Qaddafi, the main economic, commercial, financial, social, and structural institutions, they never answered directly to the government. They were outside of what Qaddafi had created as the basic people's congresses and general people's congresses structures. And that meant that they were independent power centers. So what are the main examples of semi-sovereign institutions in Libya? There's the NOC, which is the oil monopoly. There's the Libyan Investment Authority, which is the sovereign wealth fund. There's the Central Bank of Libya, GCOL, which is the electricity monopoly, the ESDF, which had been a kind of hedge fund with a social purpose. ODAC and HIB are two infrastructure monopolies. The PIB is the Privatization and Investment Board. It's also a monopoly. And the EDB, which was meant to kind of rationalize all of those other alphabet soup of institutions. So you have to keep in mind, as a foreign company doing business in Libya, you dealt with those institutions. And yet they weren't really answerable to the Qaddafi government in any linear fashion. That said, of course, they did what Qaddafi and his cronies wanted them to do. But he farmed them out to different branches of his family, his tribe, and related and loyal tribes. And each institution had its own fiefdom. So now that I've painted that picture, let's look at how the situation has changed since 2011. It's actually gotten far worse. It can be said that the heads of the CBL and the NOC today are much more powerful than either of the rival prime ministers. And by that I mean Athini or Asaraj. So since the end of the Qaddafi period, this key alphabet soup of agencies has remained the same, but who they report to has changed. Either the institutions have bifurcated into Eastern and Western versions, or they've just simply ignored their formal chains of command and operate not as semi-sovereign, but as essentially sovereign bodies. So, on a political level, we know that neither in Tobruk or Tripoli do the real quote-unquote governments hold power, because power is in the local institutions like municipal councils and militias. But then those aren't the bodies that have the power to set macroeconomic policy or issue tenders. Those are all these alphabet soup of agencies, which are not really managed by the government. So major contracts, when they need to happen, for example, to turn the lights on or get Libyan people medicine, that's really difficult to do because you have to navigate this soup. And what's frozen at the national level might be working at the local level, or what's frozen inside an institution might be working at the national level. You got the idea. So those who are doing serious business inside Libya, they really tend to derive from pre-2011 contracts. Or even if there are new contracts, they derive from pre-2011 contract networks onto which post-2011 contracts have merely been grafted. So in the case of the American companies, particularly the oil sector, I have to tell you the contractual terms of the crude sharing agreements haven't changed since the 1970s. And it's very challenging to ensure outside of the oil sector that pre-2011 contracts are honored, that current contracts are issued, and that then those are actually implemented. And of course, there's the question that Nigel raised, even when you have contracts, how do you get the security for those business assets in country? And then when you have that security, how do you adjudicate who has the jurisdiction between the government and then those semi-sovereign bodies that control the electricity, the oil, the telecoms, and all those other monopolies? It's really these feuding fiefdoms in Libya. Just as geographically, there's where do the Misratins control, where do the Zintanis control. So there's, in the 90-layer chess game of Libya, there's the economic chess game that sits above the geographic one. Now to sum up, the main issues that Western companies trying to do business in Libya face are back payments for unpaid prior work, sometimes from the Qaddafi period, but then also from the NTC period or the GNC period. It's quite common that the GNA will not necessarily prioritize the payment of back payments that were even from a post-Qaddafi government, but from one that was different than it, like the NTC or the GNC periods. Then there's the issue of letters of credit. How do you get them issued? How do you get them paid? And as Nigel mentioned, truly a security challenge for the whole country is the perverse incentive structure which the existence of the official as opposed to the black market rate of the dinar sets up. Because if you can get a letter of credit, you can smuggle money. Just as smuggling sub-Saharan Africans makes you free money, smuggling a letter of credit, absolutely free money. Wafa made a really important point in which she said there's a lack of liquidity. So in addition to smuggling money, some people have access to it, others don't, and you've got to queue in bank to get your state salary. So that's a serious problem to political reconciliation. And then Nigel also mentioned that the market is not really, the Libyan economy is not governed by market forces. I would argue that Libya is the most subsidized nation on earth. It has the cheapest foodstuffs relative to their cost of production, and it actually has the cheapest petrol, refined petrol at the pump of any nation on earth. So what does that do? That creates incentives to smuggle those things abroad and entirely distorts the supply and demand aspect of how an economy should function. So All of these issues lead to political implications that prevent solving the conflict. If you'd like to ask me about any technicalities of things like letters of credit or the dinar rates, prompt me in the Q&A. I'd like to talk about the structural challenges that particularly American firms face. We're in probably the least advantageous position of any major country's firms. Why? Well, we've got what's called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. There are various rules that govern companies, particularly oil companies in the United States, that they cannot have U.S. nationals in a country in which there is no functioning U.S. embassy. That does not apply to Britain and Italy. One, they have embassies, but even if they didn't, they can have their nationals. They don't have those rules. And then American companies have very, very high standards when it comes to media optics, international best practices, due diligence. And as Ben mentioned, we've got the fallout from Benghazi that has made Libya a curse word in certain aspects of the political spectrum, and we need to fight that together as a community. So then there's a last bit for all those State Department people out here. It's an open secret that the U.S. government doesn't advocate for American business interests in Libya, making them central in U.S. policymaking the way that, say, our European allies do. The Spanish, the Germans, to some extent the French, the Russians, and the Italian governments are very happy to say, well, we've got national interests in Libya, but more important is using our foreign ministry to get this signature on this dotted line. And the U.S. says, wait, but we've got counterterror issues and we've got geostrategy. Business issues are secondary. But what if counterterror issues, solving the political conflict and business issues are actually all the same? It's just a chicken and egg problem. So what can U.S. and Western policy do to help Libya economically, and what role can the American private sector play in that? As Ben has suggested, the U.S. is never going to lead in Libya, and I wish it was different, but it isn't. So the U.S. is not going to all of a sudden, you know, Trump is going to be like tweeting about it every day, and I'm going to have a new envoy, and I'm going to sort this out. That's not going to happen. But that doesn't mean that American firms can't help turn the lights on, get medicine in, increase oil production, which is an important barometer for how the country is doing. And then what about building the right flow charts so that this alphabet soup of feuding agencies is sorted out in any political settlement? I think we need to have functioning market mechanisms that can help Libya not waste its reserves and also produce better humanitarian outcomes for the Libyan people than the anti-market situation of the subsidies. We need to make a coherent chain of command between a stable and legitimate government and all that alphabet soup of economic institutions. And if that chain of command isn't being discussed, we're never going to have a political solution. So if the UN plan says, oh, you know, I just want to have these politicians sign a deal from the HOR and the GNA, that's a red flag, because that can't create a government which is worthy of the name of government, which can be legitimate and exert sovereignty, if it doesn't have direct links to the semi-sovereign economic monopolies. So those things were not addressed by the current Libyan political agreement, sometimes called the Sakhirat Agreement. And those financial and economic issues are part of the reasons that things have failed. What have we experienced? There are the blackouts in Tripoli, which have gotten worse under the General National Accord government. And because of subsidies, the relations between the CBL, GCAL, and the GNA have not been fixed. But I want to end on a positive note. The government of National Accord has worked hard, and oil production is tremendously up, but there are also other beneficial political knock-on effects. You know, there are deals between Misrata and Zintan. Whether it's good or bad that Haftar has been feted by various European foreign ministries, I can't say, but people are talking to each other, and there is momentum for a political process that has to do with increasing the humanitarian benefits to the Libyan people. The U.S. can help make a political coalition of the willing to try to box out spoilers, as we've heard, and align the allies. We're the ones who have the political clout in the Gulf, and we need to do that, maybe working with our British and Italian and French partners. So I think I'll call it a day there, rather than summing up with what the other key points that my colleagues have said, and kick it back over to
great.
Our panel.
Thank you all. So we've covered a lot of territory and provided all of the answers very efficiently, including the answer to what's the right role for the United States and how important is U.S. leadership. If we haven't done that, then there's still more to talk about. I have some questions for my colleagues. any of you should feel free to answer any of them. I'm going to just run through all the questions at once rather than seriatim. And then anyone who on the panel who wants to ask any other questions or respond to any of the questions, I'm happy with. We're going to do that for about 12 minutes, and then we're going to turn to you all. When we turn to you all, no, anyone who wants to speak should raise their hand. Make sure you get a microphone. Make sure you get a microphone before you speak, and make sure you identify yourself and your organization before you speak, because that way not only will people hear you, but anybody watching this later. And I won't recognize anybody until they've got that microphone in their hand to speak. May pre-recognize them, but we won't actually do it. So here are some questions. Can Libya succeed in the absence of U.S. leadership? Is U.S. leadership essential for progress in Libya, and if so, what kind of leadership? What are the right incentives and disincentives for people who care about Libya to be offering Libyans from outside or not offering? I've observed that Libyans don't always seem to trust one another very much. Is there anything that can be done to promote intra-Libyan trust? And if not, are there structural substitutes for that, or structural substitutes like a nine-person presidency council not workable? What about the role of localities versus the central government in providing services? Is there more people could be doing at the local level? And if so, how do you fund that? Is there a way to advance revenue sharing at the local level as a subset of that question? I think those are, oh yes, and can the Egyptian solution work for Libya? What I mean by Egyptian solution is a strong national military which plays the central role in national life, not only with security, but in many other realms. Is that an appropriate model for Libya or an inappropriate model? Please discuss. Lastly, I would note that there are three twin things that I believe Libya needs to solve fast, work on fast to meet the needs and expectations of the Libyan people. And they are to provide security on a national basis in some shape or form with respect at the local level, to get liquidity back into the economy so people can have normal economic activity, and to get electricity and basic infrastructure stable and secure, electricity now and water for the long term. And with that, I turn to my colleagues on this panel, answer any question. Who wants to raise their hand first? Madam Ambassador.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm going to talk a little. The first question was, can Libya succeed in the absence of U.S. leadership? Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then with that, I'm just going to go, Libyans don't trust each other. And then local municipalities versus government. So I'm going to kind of... I'm going to say in our path forward, in our journey and persistence to find a political solution, the U.S. has been a partner and has been a strong partner with along with many countries and the U.N. Itself. To that end, the situation was never easy and was never simple. And it was not like with a magic wand you can find a solution. There was a lot of complexities, and I think you heard from my colleagues here. They went into more details into many fragments, the economical, the inheritance we had of fragile institutions, how that led to the breakup of the society, of the institutions, more fragmentation, led to polarization, so the solution was not easy, and I realize with all what happened, and Ben and Jason went into the issue of the Benghazi crisis back in 2012, and then the embassy having to leave. So there were many things, but I must confess, in my position here, and following up and working closely, we always had a strong follow and support and a close follow-up on all what's going on. And to that end, not only that, but as a matter of fact, there is a lot of support that's given in probably not so much advocated for and not announced, but there is a lot of support to UNDP to support Libya. USAID is doing a lot of work. Congress has approved this year, for instance, almost 126 million to support stabilization in torn cities by the war against terrorism. So beside the military interventions here and there, there was a little bit of probably, I wouldn't say reluctance, but maybe the first few months there was, you know, we were waiting for the policies to be established for Libya and towards Libya, but we had great meetings with the U.S. government on the sides of UNGA, and we had assurances of continued support to stability of Libya, realizing that it's a strategic interest. The security of Libya is of a strategic interest to the U.S., to the region. The destabilization of Libya is destabilizing the region, stabilizing allies of the U.S. and stabilizing the area. Within the context of counterterrorism, a lot of other supports are being done. There is some training to the police, to the judiciary, police, to the supporting Ministry of Justice and prison reforms. So I am optimistic that it's going to improve with the political situation and with the clarity on the ground. So at least it will be more evident and it will show up. So I will not say succeed or not succeed. In the absence of U.S. leadership, we value the U.S. engagement with us and we value the partnership. And I think we will not be without the support of the U.S., meaning they will not leave supporting the process of peace in Libya. I don't see that. The other issue is Libyans trusting each other. Libyans don't trust each other. I think cannot define it like this. You cannot say Libyans trust or don't trust. I think the whole situation, the impact of the deteriorating humanitarian situation, the political conflict, polarization, it imposed a great amount of political polarization. Certainly, and I heard one of our colleagues here go into a lot of social media propaganda, exaggerating events and issues and promoting incentives for hatred. But at the end of the day, and this is, we have witnesses, even from the international community, they always say, no matter what happens and what we say and what we hear, when Libyans get together in a room, they have the ability to reconcile and to, come into agreement with each other in a much simpler way than we ever thought. So that's why I am saying, and I ended my briefing when I started saying that we are very hopeful now that we are finally, hopefully, taking this opportunity and more Libyans are conscious of this window to find a Libyan solution by Libyans to our crisis. And in that, we believe the positive influence of the countries and the neighbors and the region and the globe and the, you name it, will be positive and negative impact on us and on polarization will diminish, and hopefully with some time and more work on reconciliation, it will disappear. The other issue is on local municipalities versus government. It's not that would local municipalities work versus government. No, we do need a strong government. We do need a strong government that provides on security, health, education. But Libya is a huge country, And with the fragmented structure and fragmented institutions, a lot of work, I mean the result of what happened the past couple of years, a lot of work needs to be done before each city and each town and each village and each person can get services, can get health, can get education, can have access to the bank and get cash and does his business and have his kids go to school and have infrastructure, road, aside from the cities that were devastated completely by the, or not devastated, but they need more work than others. But what I am saying, decentralization here through a central government and through a proper local governance can help us so much in expediting all of this, and then it will become a mechanism. There's nothing wrong with empowering local municipalities to provide services through a national united government in a proper way. It will not work alone, no, not away from a government, but through a united central government. Otherwise, we will continue in the path of fragmentation. Each municipality is doing its work alone. Nobody knows what this municipality is doing, what's happening. And then the resources, the money, resources. We know Libya depends mostly on oil. Our revenues are mostly from oil. I mean, of course, there is encouragement to diversify our economy, to, get more probably resources through other, projects. But at this moment, as we are speaking, with these circumstances, oil remains the main source of revenue. And how the wealth is distributed, it's distributed through the central government and through the central bank and through the central government, the Ministry of Finance. So it will help so much when we have a strong local governance that will work with the Ministry of Finance to get their allocations. There is a law, law 59. It divides the country into 99 municipalities. Per population, per size, per capacity, per capability, per needs. And I think that's very needed at this time. It will help so much in also reaching reconciliation, because there's a lot of anguish, a lot of hurt, a lot of people feel marginalized in different parts of the country. I'm talking east, west, and south. It's not just this part or that, but the task has been overwhelming for the GNA. It's been overwhelming. It faced all kinds of challenges. It did the best it can under the circumstances, but the challenges are tremendous, and that's why the idea of building the capacity of local governance will contribute a lot to the stability and to the reconciliation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jonathan, I'm lucky enough, just looking at the leadership without the support or the major support of the USA, I'm lucky enough to spend 2 weeks a month in Libya at the moment and have done for the last 3 years. The big thing that I'm seeing and that I hear from the whole spectrum of Libyans that I speak to is we are not under a post-occupational regime. We are not Afghanistan. We are not Iraq. And I think that's an incredibly strong point, an incredibly important point. The Libyans have an enormous feeling of independence, an enormous pride for that. So can they survive without USA leadership? Yes. Would they appreciate leadership from the USA? Absolutely. On the incentives piece, which I think leads into it, Libyans look outside. They have a much broader Western view or view towards Europe, towards the rest of the world than a lot of people give the country credit for. So the incentive for people in Libya to behave themselves at a militia or political level is to remove that legitimacy.
Thank you. Briefly, Ben?
Quickly on the Egypt question, is the Egypt solution working for Egypt? On the U.S. Leadership question, I've thought a lot about this because our instinct in the government is to always, or at least it was in the Obama administration, to always be doing something, having a meeting on something, probably too many meetings on something. Again, can Libya survive? is a different question of, is there a solution for political solution without U.S. leadership? I hope that Salome is successful, but I am skeptical that without an active U.S. diplomatic role, it'll be much. He's already facing a giant challenge. I think if we abandon the process or not act, if our support for the process is limited to infrequent statements from the State Department of support, he's got an even tougher role. I strongly believe in some kind of local decentralization work. I think USAID already does some important pilot projects and some citizen outreach and how citizens studying how or advocating local needs to local officials. Libya has no history of that, so it's an uphill process. Obviously, it has to be in a constitutional framework. But I've long supported the decentralization of local services from a mayor having to beg in Tripoli for, a grant of whatever and being totally random under Gaddafi and that kind of thing. I'll stop there.
Okay. Very brief, and then we're going to our questions from the audience because we're going to run out of time. Let's have the microphone go to this gentleman first and then to that gentleman.
To ping-pong through these, can Libya succeed without U.S. leadership on the political mediation? I think it can't unless outside actors are boxed out without U.S. role, and that can only happen if the Europeans are united. And that doesn't seem to be the case at present, but it could happen. And I want to draw on a point that the ambassador wisely made. She said that U.S. support can be in parallel to the U.N. process, supporting it, but not necessarily only through it. That seems good to me. On the trust factor, I lived in Libya both in the Gaddafi period and afterwards, and I want to say, for those of you who haven't had that lovely and wonderful experience, Libyans are very kind people, and they don't have a history of civil war. There are no sectarian divides. The Libyan people are not violent, and they've been made violent in a way by the fallout of the uprisings, but there is genuine goodwill, even if there is distrust, so I think that's really important to get out there. And then on the local question, what Nigel called the tribal system, I don't like to call it tribal because the East has some tribes, the Saada tribes in particular, but also the Murabitin tribes, but in the West, it's really a question of localities. That's where power and loyalty and individual identity are vested in Libya at the local level. So if we can get people's governance bit to map up with their identity bit, as it has done, say, in a place like Misrata, but that kind of system can be expanded so that people feel, oh, these guys guarding my streets, they're like me. And rather than it's some Zintanis occupying a part of Tripoli or some Misratans occupying Gharghur, which caused an uprising against them. So how to decentralize those things has also to do with the economic bit and the question of devaluation and subsidies, because that'll take away the incentive for different militias to occupy strategic sectors in the country so that they can profit from smuggling and abusing them. So there is hope for Libya because of its robust social fabric. So I'd like to end on
that. Lots to discuss. Okay, let's go to audience questions, please.
Thank you. My name is Ambassador Salah Sarhan. I represent the Arab League in Washington. And thank you so much for Ambassador Wafa and the rest of the panel for their presentation about Libya. We are, as an Arab League, we are fully aware about this problem. Actually, I want to start by condemning the terrorist act accident happened yesterday in Misrata, and I think in a court compound somewhere in Misrata. So we condemn this kind of accident. This will prove that the political parties have to sit down together and reach out unified agreement. The other things I would like to tell you that we are, as an Arab League, the Arab League is playing a major role in this process. Arab League is a partner with the United Nations and European Union and the African Union to facilitate this negotiation. And we have assigned a special envoy from the Arab League to this process in Libya. So we hope by this the Libyan political parties will unify and get peace processing very quickly. And actually, we wish them the best of luck and success.
Thank you.
Bill Lawrence, George Washington University. As Libya events in Washington go, this is particularly high quality, so I want to congratulate MEI and the panel for putting together this very strong discussion. Two questions for Ambassador Wafat and for Ben Fishman. Without undoing what Salameh has taken the lead on in terms of reconciliation, you know, in terms of the ultimate solution, the ultimate deal, could the two of you say something more about what a good negotiation would look like? I know the Moroccans have some very good ideas for sort of a Sherat II. I'm thinking of the Dayton example. I'm thinking of Tunisia 2013 and that sort of 3-month intensive back channel thing, talking about Libyans getting together with Libyans. I was wondering if either of you have some thoughts on what that looks like. And for Jason and Mr. Lee, you touched on where about half of Libyans are in the economy, which is the informal economy, the black market networks. It's all linked to currency. And of course, the money for it comes from the formal economy, but then it distributes out into all these nefarious activities. Jason touched on a little bit this issue, but I was wondering if the two of you could say something more about how to deal with that half of the Libyan economy and getting that under control. For example, Prime Minister Jomah in Tunisia issued a bond, you know, that soaked up a lot of gray market capital. You know, what are some of the ideas that can deal with these informal economic issues and getting control of that? Thank you.
Okay, we're going to need 2-sentence responses. Ambassador Bugegas.
Okay. I understand you're asking what other initiatives besides the UN can work for Libya? That's a tough question because I think it took many, many, many trials and many initiatives by so many countries and so many, you know, organizations, and did not go that far. The good thing about the UN is that it has the international community under its umbrella, and that's why, and that's what we need because we had so many different initiatives and so many countries some of them with goodwill and some of them with good attention, I must say that, but too many initiatives did not help us. And that's why we believe this is the one that can work because it has the international community under one umbrella.
Ben?
I think rather than recreating a wheel for the 10th time, we should just skip with Salameh's proposal now. It's extremely ambitious. It has many stages, including a constitution drafting process, finalizing it, and holding an election within a year, which is, as I said, extremely ambitious. But the most important part of his effort is just basically to reset the players and to play the to give, I think, some renewed confidence that something is possible. And the most helpful role that the U.S. or others can play is on the backstages to, for example, the 5-day effort. They have reportedly agreed on this several steps, encourage the leadership of those factions to get behind the representatives at the conference to that they should support rather than recomplicate those efforts.
Last remarks for this panel.
How to deal with the grey money? Put pressure on the neighboring states to refuse the acceptance of smuggled goods and cash.
Have a step devaluation. Don't do what the UN, what the IMF always says, which is that you need to go all in one go. Have what the current Minister of Planning, Tahar Juhaimi, would call a stepped or phased devaluation, as was successfully executed in Libya in the 1990s, and kill the black market.
That is the completion of this session. There's lots more to talk about, and then the second panel, luckily, is going to be very, very good, much more interesting than we were. So stay tuned.